coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome back to our weekly survey of the Bible lessons for each Sunday of the church year with me, Jamie Krieger, David Weber, and Ethan Stoppenhagen. On today's episode, we will look at the lessons for the 20th Sunday after Pentecost, and they are Genesis 2 verses 18 to 25, Psalm 128, Hebrews 2 verses 1 to 18, and Mark 10 verses 2 to 16. We begin with David Weber, followed by comments and questions from Ethan Stoppenhagen.
I think this is going to be a difficult text to preach, Jesus talking about divorce, simply because everybody has an opinion about divorce in the modern world. And so the difficulty will be in sticking with the text, I think. And so what I want to do, Ethan, is just kind of lay out what I see to be the high points, and you tell me what is the heart and center, the pulse of this text. And it begins with the whole that Jesus is tested, and that we make a mistake by thinking that Jesus' adversaries were in the wrong because of their testing. At times, the testing in the scriptures it shows their stubbornness, but oftentimes they're just doing what they're supposed to do. You don't know what a person actually thinks until that you have tested that position. And what Jesus thinks on divorce, to their credit, they recognize that there was more than just divorce policy going on. And so they tested Jesus. And out of this test, out of the Mark's report here, we get a clarification about what it means to actually live believing that God's creation and God's redemption means that that we are by default living by love and not by power. Those seems to be the two choices. And while we often, everyone says, let love win or whatever, we don't live that way. And the Jesus' adversaries have a realistic sense. Yes, you can say all sorts of things and all sorts of poetic things, but if you can't live it, it's not real. And this is what happens with this test of divorce. And what we find out is the contrast is the adversaries were saying that they were defining marriage legally. They wanted to know the limits of marriage. They wanted to know how much bad would I have to put up with in this marriage? And Jesus counters not with a legal definition of marriage, but with a poetic defense of marriage. And Jesus uses this discussion of marriage to speak beautifully about the goodness and beauty of God's faithfulness, and that marriage being a participation in this faithfulness. So we have this contrast between those people who would order their lives by what is lawful, legal, allowable, and permitted. The people who love to give licenses, as we talked about last week. And this versus Jesus' alternative, which is defined, which gives a different definition of marriage. And as I said, his definition of marriage is a celebration, a participation in God's faithfulness, and that faithfulness being, the quintessential aspect of living by God's love. All right, now, what do you think of this contrast between the regulatory and the poetic?
I think it's the perfect distinction to make. That hadn't even crossed my mind that the Pharisees are getting caught up in the legalese, and Jesus actually, takes us back to the beautiful thing that God has created for us to live in.
So why do you think we like the regulatory more than we like the beautiful?
Because it's easier for us to control then. it's easier for us to get in, easier for us to get out. We can bend the regulations. We cannot bend beauty.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. Now, that would be very theoretical. I don't know how it would become a sermon, so that I'm going to keep talking and maybe something will emerge. So yeah, when I read this, the regulatory aims at weakening the bond of marriage, right? Is it such a strong bond that it can't be broken? You know, or can we give permits? Can we write out a permit for divorce? Because they're worried that Jesus' definition gives no wiggle room. There is not a way of getting out of this except for a few clauses. And they're worried, I think, more because, no one ever falls in love and says, I really hope we can get, the 5 or 6 good years out of this relationship. Everyone always promises, the church won't let people promise eternity. That's not for them, but the church does encourage people to promise until death do us part. So, I think they see that their view of marriage gives you a book of regulations. Jesus's view of marriage gives you, the beauty of poetry, that is expressed in the psalm, that if faithfulness is real, it will have intergenerational stability. And anyone living at that time, if you can have 3 generations participating with each other, may you see your children's children. You have, when you experience it, you have experienced something in this world which is remarkable, to see your children's children. I would not have known what grandkids are like and how they make you once again feel terrible about your own parenting, so you get back at your children by spoiling the grandkids. I never knew how beautiful that would be until you actually experience it, right?
And that's where the theoretical becomes reality, right? Is in the children and in the grandchildren.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that while the Pharisees would have talked endlessly about their high view of marriage, their high view of why the Jewish family was superior to the Roman family. And it was, it's oftentimes beautifully that Jesus exposed them. He said, you're not siding on the side of beauty when you want to regulate this whole thing. You have a very subtle way of wanting to be able to talk about the beautiful, but not actually live it, in which requires patience and suffering. And in order to get to the grandchildren, you got to have children. And I'm amazed that my kids actually have grandchildren, because there were times when I was ready to strangle them. And now, so they survived me, and there's a beauty to that. And then you just see it living in this world where life oftentimes was just taken so tragically and frequently, that to experience 3 generations together is seen as the epitome, almost that there isn't a rival joy such as that. All right, now, it is ironic that Jesus's, what I said, a poetic confidence in marriage is viewed not only by the Pharisees, but in other parts of the gospel, by the disciples as taking away from male freedom, and that would undermine social stability. Because if the man can't divorce freely, the argument goes, no one will marry. That's hilarious in a way, because it is so cynical. And, at one point, the disciples even asked Jesus, if this is true, who would marry? And if no one's going to marry, how are you going to get kids? And so they saw Jesus undermining the social stability by having this high view of faithfulness. And so that doesn't surprise me. What surprises me is the way that Jesus then is tries to convince, not tries, I think he successfully convinces, that his view is not actually as threatening as they see it. And he does it again. The question is such a big important part of this. The adversaries know that they can question Jesus and will get a real answer back. And so Jesus returns the favor by asking them about their interpretation of Moses. You know, Moses was a regulator. He was gave permission. And when he gave permission to divorce, what actually there? And they were very quick. Moses gave the man the right to send away the woman, right? So Jesus lets them put into their own words, what they think, and almost saying, now try to turn that into a love poem. Try to say, I will love you, but I maintain the permission to send you away at my will. That is going to grate against anything that is slightly understood as love. And what Jesus is going to show is that view of conditional love, that view of, changing commitment, it lacks the beauty to attract and the power to change. It will not have any of the power. Now, we know from history that this beauty to attract and the power to change was very much, it energized the Christian outreach in the Roman world, which was ruled by sexual promiscuity and male domination. That the paterfamilias was something that in the early church they recognized that if Jesus was true, then the Roman understanding of the family could not be true. And because Jesus had, as you had already alerted us, the people victimized by this view of divorce were the women and children who were deprived of the physical means to keep them secure, and you cannot flourish if you are not secure. And so the Romans trumpeted how, what strong families they actually had. And Jesus comes along with a point of view and says, no, not really. It appears to be strong only because tyrannies always prove to be stronger than organizations that deal in patience and love and freedom. So Jesus gives him a chance to say, here, what do you think Moses was saying? And then he interprets it. So really what you want is this permission, which reflects not that you have a generous heart, not that you have a loving heart, but that you have a hard heart. Oh, and try to put a hard heart into poetry, into love poetry. Try to write a psalm about the benefits of a hard heart. Anyone who has been victimized by a hard heart recognizes it only serves the hard-hearted. It does not serve anybody but anybody else. So the alternative is to participate in the heart of God. What's God's heart like? And then Jesus talks about it in poetically. God's heart was expressed in creation from the very beginning. In the physical creation was this metaphysics of God's love from the beginning. And then we'll get in Genesis that this is expressed in poetry. It might be the worst romantic poetry ever written of Adam. You are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. But it's poetry nonetheless. That's how Adam expresses this bond of love. And later on, Adam is going to be on the side of the regulators when he starts blaming Eve and wanting out of the relationship. That's going to always be there. But what I like about this passage is Jesus says that the fall has not negated the cosmic reality of God's faithfulness that can be that we participate in marriage. And no amount of dry legal language is going to get at the mystery that is finally, and the real mystery is the fruitfulness and fecundity of a marriage that the two become one flesh. And then no sooner are there a bunch of other fleshes taking place. And we live in a culture in which that's a liability to love. Children are now viewed as liabilities, that they don't enhance love. They don't extend our participation in God's faithfulness. They actually ruin things, by making them more complex. So, So I think this, we get to the end, and the question for me is the cosmos tilted towards fragmentation, or is it, as Jesus says, it is on the path of reconciliation? We know what we think by what we think of marriage. If we think that the world is actually, by virtue of Christ's cross, tilted towards reconciliation, our view of marriage will be reflective of what Jesus thinks. And if our view of marriage is reflective of what Jesus thinks, it will be manifested in our attitude towards children. And as we've said, this is not children in some romantic sense. The word child is paideia, in which we get the word pedagogy, in which if we're, our attitude towards children will not be in a romantic view of the child as innocent. It will be evident in the child as the image of potentiality and what it takes to bring out that potentiality in a child. And the answer is faithfulness. The child needs stability. The child needs the kind of stability that he or she can say to the parents, "I hate you." The child can only say that if he knows that that is not going to break things apart, and that's the kind of faithfulness that God experienced, as you said last week, that the children of Israel said to him, "We hate you. We hate how you're treating us." And while that's horrible, it also is a sign that of a deeper faithfulness and stability that allows a child to flourish and to grow and to come to full maturity and for generations to give rise to generations. So you see any sermon in that?
A less controversial sermon, because what it does is I think it presents, instead of taking the legalistic approach, because I think that would be the tendency of some, is to take Jesus' words about the beauty and the fecundity of marriage and turn it into a new law. Whereas I think the way you present it, really sort of shows the vibrancy and the freedom that comes. I mean, there's a freedom, but there's a tension, of course, between the freedom and the duty. That's all resolved, I think, by reconciliation, right? That the world is curving towards reconciliation rather than towards judgment or towards punishment. So yeah. I think there's a lot there.
Yeah. Well, the psalm carries it on forward, and it says it presumes that God's presence in our life will make us so that we desire to walk in His ways. I think and that's not a rule. That is an invitation, you know, to walk in God's ways sounds like the height of hubris. Who can walk like God? And that's the beauty of, you know, the Christian life. It's a participatory thing. It's saying you're not going to, you may think you walk in a godly way, but we're going to do it so badly that we have to regularly repent of our inability. But yet it's so inviting to say that God is the limit of our potentiality, and His faithfulness defines the boundaries of what faithfulness, and there are no boundaries, right? And so When we ourselves have experienced the beauty of His faithfulness, and for me, it's the remarkable generosity that He never runs out of the patience to grant repentance. That to me is a freedom. If I know that I can repent and screw up, I'm going to be more bold in doing things that maybe in retrospect I'm going to have to say it wasn't so smart. At least it is the occasion for forgiveness. So in this case, the audacious thing that the psalm celebrates is getting married and having children. You want to do something crazy? Get married. You want to do something crazier? Have children. And what you will discover is the wife is like a fruitful vine, the children like olive shoots. Now, if you are a lover of good wine, you will be a lover of good vines, and all of that then is this great image of celebration that the cup of wine, or like the olive shoots of the importance of olive oil in the olives, all of that are things that are regularly consumed and yet elevate us into the, you know, the sense that we are eternal, that, that growth is moving away from fragmentation and into reconciliation. And we experience that cosmic reality in marriage and the family. So, and I like about it is that it's poetic, but it's not romantic. You know, Jesus's view is not romantic. Everyone there recognizes it is something which is, seems to be beyond, humanity. And it is. We are not being taught to be good humans. We are being taught to be godly. And that's ridiculous and exceptional and inspiring. So, and the Psalm celebrates this. What we really want is prosperity. Well, how much prosperity? All the days of your life. You want to be prosperous? Then you want life to increase. You want life to increase? Then marry. And see what happens when the two become one flesh. And life increases not by your selfish life becoming more comfortable, but by having children who have children. And, you know, it's not, we live in a time when the child is considered a liability. And it's what a wonderful time then to reclaim and recover this idea that's expressed in the Psalm. And again, like I said, it's a grueling, hard idea. It is not romantic or easy. And yet you can't argue with it that it is essentially life giving way to life giving way to life. And the psalm ends if that is the way of peace. So,
but my question is there still hidden in here, and maybe the Genesis passage will push us there. Is it, you're talking about, you know, life giving way to more life, but isn't there still a little bit of death hidden in all of this?
Oh yeah. No, death is, yeah. Yeah, if you don't suffer marriage as a kind of death, it's not marriage. That's why I'm saying it's unpoetic. It is the death.
Right,
of
right. That's what I think. It's not, it's poetic, but it's not romantic, right?
Well, not romantic, yeah. Right. It is the death of the fat, insatiable ego. If Iris Murdoch is right that the purpose of any spiritual life is to kill our fat, insatiable ego, then nothing like marriage is there. And in my reading, people said that God gave us marriage because He wants us to teach us to learn to love our enemies. That's funny. But it's true. and then you see how crucial when you have your children, how crucial it is that you reconcile, that you learn to love your enemies. And then not that they remain enemies, but that you are united because you have this common love for the children. So, and what I like about Jesus' presentation of this is that he spells out the cosmic, importance. Creation is the in the beginning, and that word beginning is a saturated word. It's arche, and whenever you see the word arche, then you have to say somewhere there's a telos, there's an end. That in the beginning, there is also the end. And as I repeat over and over again, we talk about that arche telos connection is in a liturgical moment when we say, as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, world without end. And that world without end is what defines love. Is there such a love that does not ever end? Is there such a way in which we can talk about eternal love? And Jesus says, yes, in the beginning, that love was expressed in solving the problem of Adam's loneliness. That is the condition. Now, loneliness in our culture has become lethal. It is, presently they talk about deaths of despair. that loneliness leading to suicide or the slow suicide of drug abuse. And all of it is related. This isn't just from biblical scholars or from the church. This is from, you know, major think tanks are recognizing that the retreat from the family has increased this lethal loneliness. So from the very beginning, God recognized how lethal loneliness could be. And what is interesting is that the Genesis 2 talks about Adam having all of the lower animals as his companions and God as his companion. So you have the lower animals, you have God, but yet there is something still missing. There is that God is, I hate to say it this way, but God and the lower animals are inadequate to solve the problem of loneliness. And so Adam's, you know, he suffers a paradynamic loneliness that can only be solved by the creation of Eve. And as I said, the worst poem ever, this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. So Adam recognizes she's like me, but she's not like me. We are the same, but we are other. Right? She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. So you have right there this beautiful thing of creation of things that join us and things that are different. That's and somehow only that the thing that reconciles those two conflicting realities is this God's love. And then the last part, which it's just more interesting, it won't enter into the sermon, is that they were naked and not ashamed. And then soon in the next chapter, they are naked and they are blaming one another. So quickly the bond that was celebrated in chapter 2 dissipates in chapter 3. And then in chapter 4, you get a new poem, Lamech, who poeticizes power. And writing a poem to his two wives, that's important. So that poem, when we read the poem in Genesis 2, we should recognize that there will be another contrasting poem in Genesis 4 that gives the opposite point of view. And those are the two poems that help us understand the gospel. What the conflict is in the gospel as to what is the nature of marriage. And finally, I will just touch on Hebrews as just saying that when marriage and the family is the metaphor at the heart of things, you recognize why it makes sense of things like, the passage saying, I and the children God has given me. That our relationship with God is predicated on our understanding of what it means to be a child and what it means to have a father and a mother. And recognizing that if this family, which is both that, you know, Jesus is talking about concretely and metaphorically, that is the thing which makes sense of Jesus's love that expresses itself in suffering of death. As you had mentioned, Ethan, when we're talking about this stuff, we're talking about talking about love. You cannot talk about love without talking about suffering and without talking about death. That is the highest expression of the bond of love, of freely suffering for the sake of others. And that's the poetic beauty of Jesus's view of that his view of marriage is a frontal attack on the fat and satiable ego. And when you see the possibility of what happens when the ego is killed, when the old man is killed, and the love that can emerge from that, that's where Jesus's view of marriage is both has the beauty to attract and the power to change and save.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app, download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.